This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Dear Sugar is supported by...
The universe has good news for the lost, lonely, and heartsick. Sugar is here, the both of us, speaking straight into your ears. I'm Cheryl Strayed.
I'm Steve Almond. This is Dear Sugar Radio.
Oh, dear soul, won't you please share some bittersweet days with me?
Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Steve. Welcome to part two of our series on weddings and questions around weddings and getting ready for weddings.
Yeah. People who listened last week would have known that a lot of our rapid fire questions were about the run up to the wedding,
yes,
the squabbling, the invite list, who gets invited, who doesn't. And this week's letter is going to be very much more about the event and the aftermath.
Yes.
Did you have any eventful events?
Eventful events. You know, one of the things, so many of those letters we answered last week were about people who were being challenged during the sort of wedding planning time.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, I love to organize things. I really do. And my friends gave me so much crap because in the months before the wedding, my entire house, the walls of my house were lined with butcher paper. And on it, I had done these like color-coded lists and charts and graphs and maps. And I planned everything within an inch of its life. You know, my wedding day was going to go exactly the way I wanted it. And people were going to sit here and then they were going to go there. And I did wake up the morning of my...
Was there a flow chart
There was
involved?
A flow chart.
I mean, some people actually,
there are photographs somewhere. Somebody went and took a bunch of pictures. They're legendary among my friends who knew me back then.
The strayed charts.
Yeah, and they're very much in line with who it turns out I am. There's nobody who likes to make a list more than me. And so my wedding gave me lots of opportunities to do that.
Yes.
It was very exciting. I was madly in love with Brian and excited to have the wedding. And so many of our friends from all over the world flew to be with us. We got married in Stevenson, Washington, on the other side of the Bridge of the Gods, which spans the Columbia River. People who have read Wild know that I actually finished my hike on the Oregon side of that bridge, and I crossed that bridge 4 years later and married my husband.
Hmm.
And I woke up the morning of my wedding feeling that mix of things that I have felt, honestly, at every momentous occasion in my adult life, and that is happy and sad. When you have a dead mother who you loved, everything good that happens to you in your life after she dies is something that happens to you without your mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I know so many listeners have that experience where they have a parent who has passed before one's wedding day, and there is sorrow in not getting to share that with that parent. And we brought my mom, or the memory of my mom, into the wedding ceremony. We mentioned her. Brian wore a rosemary boutonniere because rosemary is for memory. And so he wore this in memory of my mother. And his father had died a month before our wedding. And
even though
they weren't terribly close, there was this sense of, you know, honoring their memory during the ceremony.
Sure.
But that morning when I woke up, one of the things I was so grateful for is that my brother was there. And in the days leading up to the wedding, nobody in my family had planned to attend. And I was feeling sad about that.
Yeah.
And so kind of at the last minute, I called my brother and I said, if I buy you a plane ticket to fly from Minneapolis to Portland, will you get on the plane? And he said, of course.
Oh, good.
And so he did. And it was so meaningful to me that my brother was there. And he ended up standing up with Brian as one of our groomsmen.
Aww.
And it was a beautiful, powerful thing. And I think that there are so many ways that since my mom died, that it's been hard for me to always be very tightly connected to my siblings. But I will say, you know, standing there with my brother, you know, on this day that I married Brian, it was really meaningful to me, really powerful. So I woke up, it was an emotional morning, thinking, okay, my brother is here. I wished that my sister were there. And here I was going to step into the next era of my life.
Yeah. And it really speaks to what we're going to try to take on, which is, you know, this long psychological, emotional, logistical ramp that gets built that culminates in this event, one day, and everything that really gets unleashed, not just the good, beautiful, graceful things, the commemorations and the emotional events that need to occur between the participants and the families, but also some of the darker impulses which kind of lie in wait and get triggered by an event of this kind of emotional magnitude.
Yeah. They don't call it the big day for nothing.
Right.
And that's really the theme of this episode, the big day. We're going to talk to one of the greatest experts of the big day.
Maybe the.
Probably the. Yeah. Lois Smith Brady. She is the founding columnist of the famous Vows column in the New York Times. She's witnessed many weddings going back many years. And I'm so excited to talk to her about what she has observed when it comes to weddings in America.
Right.
Hello?
Hi, is this Lois Smith Brady?
Yes, it is. Lois Smith Brady. Is this a sugar? One of the sugars?
This is the male sugar. Yes, I'm Steve Allman, and I'm here with Cheryl Strayed.
Hi, Lois.
Oh, hey, how are you? I'm so flattered and so thankful that you guys gave me a call and asked me to help out with wedding drama advice.
My God,
well,
you are the one.
Yeah, you're like the queen of weddings.
Oh, you're so sugary.
It's true, though. You've seen it.
That's right. So you're the founding columnist of the Vows column in the New York Times. How long have you been doing that?
The first column that I wrote appeared in May of 1992, so almost 24 years.
Oh, my goodness. What's the process? Can you tell us what's the process?
Oh, well, I'm the original wedding crasher.
Yeah.
I go to a wedding with usually a photographer as well. So I always have a date, but I do actually attend the ceremony, always the ceremony and the reception if it works out for the couple. And it usually does work out for the couple. And I usually stay through the cocktail hour. That's when I ask questions. I always carry a really big notebook so that people know she's a reporter and don't think, oh, she's kind of not a very well-dressed wedding guest. Because I also dress down. I kind of dress like a caterer or maybe, you know, a member of the band, like someone who's
like
working the wedding in some way. Yeah, thank you. A roadie is exactly how I dress.
And you go around and, like, you really want to, obviously, in your columns, you know, you give this such a vivid and personal and intimate view of this day and this couple. And what do you look for? I mean, what are you trying to do when you write those vows columns?
Well, first of all, I think that weddings not only create a lot of drama, they do almost always, but it's just this amazing time when, especially the bride and groom, but it kind of extends out into their wedding parties and their families. Everybody's just opens up. And sometimes that can be negative. It can be people saying terrible things about the bride and groom or their own marriages. Or there's just something where everyone becomes incredibly honest, vocal, and it's very easy as a reporter most of the time to just have people tell you their life stories, their deepest secrets. People just become so confessional. I really think I've learned that people want to confess,
yes,
but they can't really do that in everyday life, but they can with it if they find a wedding reporter at a wedding, because they're thinking about love and they're thinking about their own situation, whatever it is, wherever they are in love, and people want to tell you a lot of very personal things, and the bride and groom will tell you everything.
When you're at weddings, you know, when you're actually working a wedding, do you ever cry during the ceremony? Are you moved?
Oh, yes, all the time. You know, sometimes I'm very bored. Some weddings are incredibly boring. But I would say most of the time, they're really emotional. And there's a photographer, Ed Keating, who I started the column with, and I have to give him a whole lot of credit. Hi, Ed, if you are possibly out there listening.
He totally is.
He just so set the tone for the column from the very beginning. His photographs were really offbeat and also very close up and personal, not anything like, oh, pose and look beautiful and perfect.
Right.
He was
right.
always looking for the imperfect thing. But we would stand at many weddings on the sides together, and we were both newly married when we started the column. So we would stand there. We were often the same age as the bride and groom and all the guests, and we would stand there and go, we are just not that in love. Are you that in love with your spouse? We made a mistake, you know. So, yeah, weddings are most of the time, even ones that you might define as a disaster in some way, are just incredibly emotional, and you really feel the bigness of the decision that they're making and the action that they're taking.
Yeah.
So, Lois, tell us, you know, we want some dirt here. We would love to hear some of the, like, wedding disaster stories. I mean, we've just been through the, like,
okay.
It's so beautiful and they cried and everything. But what about, you know, when
bring
things
us into
went
the
wrong.
Gutter. Bring Let's, us into the mud.
I'll bring you into the mud very easily. One of my most favorite disasters, and I think brides can really learn a lot from this, just in the sense that this bride so beautifully rose to the occasion. I was covering a wedding in New York City of a couple who, I believe, if I recall correctly, the groom was a doctor and the bride was something equally prestigious. And they were having a wedding at St. Vincent Ferrer, which is a beautiful, very traditional church in New York, followed by a reception at a really nice, staid, old-fashioned club. And at the rehearsal the night before the wedding, so this would be Friday night, everything was going along smoothly, and the groom just freaked out and got severe cold feet. And at first, I guess he went and confided in the priest and said, I just can't go through with it. So it turned out he just actually really did just desert the entire wedding and leave the bride at the altar, even in the rehearsal. So she had the wherewithal. Of course, the wedding the next day, the ceremony was canceled. Everybody was called. I got the call on Friday night from her that the wedding had been canceled. But the reception was very expensive, and she didn't feel that they should waste money, so she decided that they were going to go ahead with the reception at the club. So she went to Vera Wang. She had gotten her wedding dress at Vera Wang on Madison Avenue, beautiful place to get your wedding dress.
And not a cheap place to get your wedding dress.
No, not a cheap place at all. She went on Saturday and got a black dress and showed up at the reception in a black gown. And all of the guests, oh my gosh, I've never been to such a quiet reception. Everybody sort of tiptoed in because obviously everyone knew it had been canceled. The wedding had not happened, but there was the bride and she was just amazing and she was glowing.
Oh my goodness. I want this woman's number. She is my hero. That is beautiful and cool.
She just like really made it a wonderful time for everyone, for her family. Everybody was there. And I think that when drama does happen at weddings or disasters, it's always good to remember a bride like that.
Yeah. Did you write about that?
I did write about that one. And the amazing thing is that the reception went on and then they were scheduled to go on a honeymoon. And she, I think, went, if I recall correctly, she went on the honeymoon by herself. And then he decided to go and meet her. And they ended up marrying a week later by themselves on a beach in Mexico.
Wow.
So they did get married.
Oh, my God.
You know what I say? Smart guy.
Yeah. I'm surprised he survived the honeymoon. I mean, that's amazing.
But what grace under pressure.
Yeah.
I mean, to think of taking that moment that could be, you know, this is Miss Havisham, you know, at 20 minutes to nine. She's basically taking that narrative of the jilted bride who lives forever in the attic of our fears and saying, no, actually, I refuse to adhere to that. I'm going to rewrite the story. I'm going to get a beautiful dress. I'm going to have a party. And I mean, I can see what this guy's very lucky. I think he recognized. We will make sure that we have a link to the story if you'll send us that so our readers can check out that account.
Okay.
So, you know, you always are crafting these narratives that are very focused on, as you say, you know, the story of how the couple came together and courted and planned this event and then the event itself. Are there things that you notice or that are in your notebook that have not made it into a particular column because they don't fit that narrative. Like the first husband or first wife or, you know, the sobbing uncle who tells you something that you're like, I can't use that. But if I was a short story writer, I sure would.
You know, there has been more than one occasions where in a second marriage, someone has really clearly, the bride or the groom, has clearly divorced the first time because they had an affair that was going on when they were married,
mm-hmm.
and they ended up marrying that person. That's common, mm-hmm. incredibly common. But we never, as a policy, I would never write, you know, he fell in love and this affair began halfway through his first marriage.
And I'd love to read that vow column.
But it's always in there. I am sure that people always can read that in there because, you know, we have to be factual about when they met. And often you can tell that they met during the first marriage.
Right.
Yeah.
So affairs are so incredibly common, but I don't get into the details of the affair in print. For sure, that's left in the notebook.
Now, do you ever get a sense that either the father or mother of the groom or the bride feel something other than unequivocal joy at this event?
Oh, yes. In general, one of my favorite type of wedding is an elopement, which I think is a great way to escape all the drama of weddings.
Thank you.
If you go to City Hall, for instance, in New York, which I would do whenever there was slow wedding season, like in the middle of February in a snowstorm and you needed to cover a wedding because we had to cover it every single weekend,
right.
The backup would always be, okay, I'm going to go down to City Hall and catch a couple getting married down there. And the place is full of people who are escaping their unhappy mothers and fathers or escaping something most of the time. But mothers and fathers will not necessarily confide in me at the wedding that they're very unhappy with what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't hear that firsthand. And also, you know, bridesmaids and bridegrooms, they're like worse than PR people. You know, the bridegrooms and the bridesmaids are always like guarding me and watching me and making sure that I'm not getting any of that information.
Right.
I mean, oftentimes I do get a list of people I cannot speak to.
Oh, really?
That's very common. Because I'll sometimes ask couples, you know, who's really funny among your wedding guests or your wedding party? Who do you think would speak well for why you guys are a great couple? And the more common email that I'll get back is, well, this is who you absolutely cannot speak to. And if I do go near those people, and sometimes those people I can see, they're kind of rule breakers or rebels, and they'll come to me and I'll be like, no, you're the brother of the groom. I cannot speak to you.
Oh,
and if I'm
God.
Speaking
wow.
to them, there will be somebody who will come over. Like I was covering a wedding in Snowbird, Utah once, speaking to the subject of protective bridesmaids. And, you know, the couple were from New York City, but they were skiers and they loved to ski at Snowbird. So they had their wedding there and the ceremony was fine. Everything went beautifully. And I was in the cocktail hour asking questions, very innocuous, like what makes this couple a perfect couple and so in love with each other and why are they a great match? And this mob of bridesmaids, like 10 of them, came running toward me like bumblebees, like, stop, do not answer her questions anymore.
Oh my God.
And leave. So people are protective of all that information, so I don't always get very close to it.
Have you been, Lois, at a wedding where there has been the sort of sudden appearance of an actor like this who kind of takes the attention? I know you wouldn't be allowed to interview him and maybe might even not choose to write about that, but does it sound at all familiar to you?
Well, at my own wedding, I was married in 1988 in New York, and this is something that I have always regretted about my own wedding. At the rehearsal dinner the night before, it was at a kind of stiff, formal yacht club. This doesn't concern my parents, but it does concern a kind of crashing. And we were having dinner at this yacht club the night before, and everybody was very dressed up, and this was like a place where you wore, you know, suit and tie, and all the women were in dresses, no blue jeans at all. And two very old friends of mine showed up uninvited. They had just arrived in town early. They knew we were at this yacht club, and they showed up in their jeans and sneakers. And they looked like they had been climbing trees together for, like, the whole day. And they were coming to have something to eat. The woman was my oldest friend, or one of my oldest friends from growing up. She had lived around the corner from me. She taught me to smoke when I was 10. She taught me all my swear words.
Good
influence.
She
remained
okay.
A rebel all the way to my wedding. And I was listening to the caterers and my mother-in-law and everybody who said, no, they cannot come into this room. So I actually made my very best friend from childhood sit outside in the waiting room while we had dinner inside. And I really do regret that. That's not exactly your parent.
Right.
But it was a kind of crashing, and I handled it really badly.
Mm-hmm. Now, since you have been writing about and observing these weddings for so many years, you've really presided over an era during which weddings have changed in a really notable way, and that is there's not always a bride and a groom. Sometimes
right.
It's two brides, sometimes two grooms, right? And you've covered those in the vows column, is that correct?
Yes.
Tell us about that experience. First of all, really, the first time, were you the author of the first column in the New York Times that covered a lesbian or gay wedding?
Yes, I was. And it was a gay wedding. And it took us a while. A couple of other newspapers and magazines and just news outlets covered gay weddings before we finally decided, or it wasn't even my decision, but it was decided that gay weddings would be in the Times. And there was a little bit of trepidation on everyone's parts about what will people's response be. But it was 100% celebration. Mm-hmm. We didn't get any letters or any negative response to that. And I think that's continued to be true.
And have you found that gay weddings are like straight weddings? Are they similar in more ways than they're dissimilar?
Well, there's more crying at gay weddings, in my experience.
Oh, really?
They're so emotional.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's just a release for everybody.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
And there's just more emotion, and I think that's still true. Mm. I just feel every gay couple has overcome so much, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many things. And that's what love is all about, really, is,
yeah.
You know, it's not a great love story if it's easy. I don't think.
Mm-hmm. And also, you're witness to this event that is so cathartic.
Yeah.
You know, it is the end result, the culmination of a whole long narrative of, you know, meeting, courting, you know, getting engaged, and then planning an event. And it's that big day where it all kind of explodes on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Are there particular cases that, you know, you have in mind where there's a really tough path to the altar for the bride and groom, or bride and groom and groom?
There's so many, but I guess the classic ones would be the people, the New Yorkers, this was always my soft spot, who are single for a really long time, especially, you know, when I started writing this column in 1992, it was right after the 80s when there was the Newsweek article that said single women in New York had about as much chance of finding a mate and getting married as they did meeting a terrorist on an airplane. And that was just, everybody talked about that then. Oh my God, I'm never going to meet a terrorist or a boyfriend or ever get married. There was a lot of hysteria at this particular period in New York. And single women, especially as single women as they got older in New York, just truly became really upset and worried. So for me, as a single woman, or just as a woman feeling it for them, the ones that were single for a long time, like there's a woman named Aaliyah Zobel who actually wrote a book called The Joy of Being Single. And I covered her wedding. She was probably 45. She wouldn't tell me her exact age, even though that was a rule of the New York Times. You have to tell your age. But she dug in her heels, and her story was so good, we just said about 40. But she had been single for a long time. And like the woman who wore the black dress to her reception, she decided to make the best out of it. She wrote books about it. She also wrote a book called 101 Reasons Why a Cat is Better Than a Man. And she talked about all the ways that being single is so great, and, you know, became a successful author, and then met a guy much younger than her, super cute Irishman, who also was very into being single, but at the same time felt like, wow, I'm kind of perpetually single. So those are the ones, the people who find each other after a very long time, mm-hmm. of being kind of miserable but not showing it, or somehow being graceful in their misery. Yeah, those are the ones that really I find make the greatest stories. But then there are people who have been widowed early. That's actually not uncommon. People who have whose spouses have died when they're in their 20s or 30s, and they find love again when they never think they will.
Right.
That's beautiful.
Also, there's just great love stories. I mean, one of my favorite stories about how a couple met was the bride-to-be, the woman who became the bride, was walking down a rainy sidewalk in New York. Her boyfriend of 7 years had just broken up with her, and she was crying openly. And a guy was riding by in a taxi cab, and because it was raining, it was super trafficky. And so his taxi cab was going really slowly, and he was going just about as fast as she was walking, and jumped out of the cab and followed her for several blocks. Excuse me, can I talk to you? And finally got her first name and where she worked. And he tracked her down, sent her flowers. They finally had a first date on a night that there was a snowstorm in New York, which is the most romantic time in New York. And
right.
They ended up getting married.
I know. And like, this, the beautiful part is, Cheryl, you don't know this, but I read the column. He's a terrorist.
Well, one thing I was going to say about that is it ended up that the guy was one of the most successful Wall Street bankers in New York.
God.
And what I loved about that story is everyone in New York is looking for that guy, like going everywhere they possibly can. So also the best love stories are the ones where people are not trying or really making an effort. They're not making a list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So listen, we're going to read not such a beautiful story.
Exactly.
To you right
we take you from that beautiful cinematic moment back into
the heights, to the depths.
Exactly.
And we have a letter from a listener, and we would love for you to listen to it. Steve's going to read it to us and help us answer it. Can you stay on the line?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
All right.
Here we are.
Dear Sugars, I'm a 25-year-old woman, and I got married last year. My husband has been a part of my family for years, so I always thought that our wedding would be a great moment of joy shared with my parents and sister. It wasn't. Our wedding started the collapse of everything I've ever known to be true. I've always been close to my dad, yet as we were planning our wedding, he was so controlling I had to step in and say no. He stopped talking to me about 5 months before my wedding. I tried to reach out to him, but he never responded. A month before my wedding, I sent him an email asking if he was even coming to the wedding and if he'd be walking me down the aisle. He didn't respond, but he did tell my mom that he wouldn't be there, which broke my heart. I don't know what I did wrong. Much to my surprise, he showed up at the wedding 2 minutes before I was meant to walk down the aisle. I plastered a smile on my face, but on the inside I was screaming. I didn't want him there. I felt betrayed and bombarded. It was like he had hijacked the day. He told me to have a nice life and left at some point during the reception. I haven't seen him since and have barely heard from him. That was over a year ago. To make it all more complicated, 2 weeks before my wedding, he had left my mom. They tried to patch things up, but just last month he said he was filing for divorce. Since then, he has said terrible things about and to my mom. He claims that she ruined his life and badmouths her to my sister, who he talks to, and all of their friends. To be honest, my mom is probably better off on her own. I know that I didn't cause my dad to act like he did, and that my parents have probably never had a perfect marriage. The past year of therapy has helped me realize that. But I am the catalyst. You see, I'm the reason that he left her in the first place. My mom stood up for me when he was trying to control my wedding, and he says that she, quote, betrayed him when she did this, and that after she stepped in, their marriage was done. I wish I could say there is more to the story, but as far as I know, there isn't. Sugars, I can't come to terms with the guilt that I feel for causing this. At times, it consumes me. On top of the guilt, I feel so betrayed. My life has revolved around my dad for as long as I can remember. I have been a good, loyal daughter, and I always put my family first. Almost every decision I made was to make my dad proud. I have apologized for whatever he thinks I did wrong many times, but he can't forgive me. He has said that I am disrespectful, ungrateful, and a monster. He has claimed that I uninvited him from our wedding. I never did this. I only ever wanted to be a good daughter. Despite everything he has done and all of the hurt he has caused, I feel so sad for him. I don't understand why he is pushing us all away. I break down in tears every time I think of him growing old and being all alone. Who will love him like we do? Who will he let love him if he won't let even us? So what do I do, Sugars? Do I confront my dad about these terrible lies he says about our family? Do I give my parents space to sort things out and just stay out of the way? Or am I simply better off without him? Signed, Daddy's Girl, No More.
Lois, on part one of our two-part wedding episode, we answered a whole bunch of letters, and so many of them, in fact, all of them, they were about the wedding planning. This is where it seems like a lot of people can manage to have conflict-free wedding days, but all of this planning for the wedding, which causes all kinds of grief, and here is where Daddy's Girl No More, this is where the trouble started. She wasn't willing to have the wedding that her father wanted her to have. She doesn't detail what those things were, but it doesn't really matter, right? It was up to her to have her say, and she declined to obey her father. And it had huge consequences.
My reading on the letter, to be honest, is that this is a dad who has, you know, been sort of self-involved and controlling and probably, you know, a narcissistic personality disorder or something, because the emotional world of his daughter and his family has revolved around him from the beginning. But what's clear to me, Daddy's Girl No More, is that for a long time you have been putting your dad's happiness before yours, and it's been more important than your own happiness. And it sounds like that's been a pattern since long before you got engaged and planned a wedding and had a wedding. And the sad truth is that this wedding is really the moment that is revealing that that is profoundly unhealthy. And, you know, obviously as a loyal daughter, you can see the sad state of somebody who needs to make that day that's supposed to be so special and in which a dad is supposed to be, I think, especially concerned about the happiness of his daughter, and instead becomes this crazy ritual that he hijacks and makes all about him, his grievance, his shame that he can't express honestly, and so it is in the form of this distorted, destructive appearance. That doesn't offer a solution, but it is at least a sort of clear diagnosis of the fact you didn't do anything wrong
here.
You
didn't. I really do think we're dealing with somebody who clearly has some mental issues. You know, a normal, rational person does not behave this way in response to his daughter saying, I want to plan my wedding.
Yeah.
Lois, what do you make of this letter?
Well, one thing I will say is I think of all the figures in the drama of a wedding, the father, especially a father of a daddy's girl, is really carrying a lot of emotion. I mean, there is no father whom I've personally ever witnessed their speech at a wedding, speaking to their daughter, who doesn't just fall apart.
Yeah.
It is really difficult for fathers to say goodbye to their daughters. Look at me, I'm crying. No. But seriously, it's such a passage for them, especially the father and daughter. The father and daddy's girl relationship is so powerful.
That's right. And Daddy's Girl No More has defined herself. You know, you've defined yourself as this good, loyal daughter. That's such a paradigm where essentially the dad, especially if he's a guy who's sort of self-involved, and by that I mean weak and needy, you know, if you have consented to an arrangement where you're really always sort of guarding that secret weakness that plays out as a kind of self-involvement.
I think the thing to aim for is to somehow, you know, make a bridge.
Right.
As horrible as this particular father of Daddy's Girl behaved, I would keep trying to make a bridge because he's obviously in so much pain.
Yeah.
And I
yeah.
think you just don't want to lose that relationship.
Yeah, and I think, too, Daddy's Girl, think about a couple of things. The first is that it sounds to me, I could be wrong, but when you decided to plan your own wedding and not do everything your father told you to do, it might have been the first time you really defied him. And you defied him also at this moment, as Lois pointed out, that I know this is a kind of patriarchal, kind of ridiculous way to view it, but part of the reasons that fathers who are close to their daughters have problems at their weddings, you know, or are at least emotional at the weddings, is that it is this kind of, it marks this time where he's, you know, at least in metaphorical terms, you're leaving his home for another, you know, and he's in some ways handing you into the world, you know, via your wedding and your marriage. And I don't adhere to those values myself, but I think that a lot of people feel that kind of in their bones, you know, and that's why, in part, that this moment is so emotional. So, you know, your dad behaved badly at a time of greatly heightened emotions. And then in this year after the wedding, he's also in another bad time.
Right.
He's getting divorced. He's not at his best right now. You know, and I think there's this way that you, you know, don't feel guilty. Don't take responsibility for what is not yours. Your dad's bad behavior is not your fault. You didn't do anything. You did the right thing. But make room in your heart to be generous, to sometimes let, you know, bygones be bygones. Because I do think that, Lois, you're right. Who knows if he'll cross that bridge, but if you at least, you know, build it, it's there.
Mm-hmm. Or at least try. Yeah. Offer the possibility.
And it sounds like she's doing that.
Yeah.
You know, she's reached out numerous times and said, I apologize if I offended you. So, like, that is, girl, I actually think keep doing what you're doing. Maybe just keep the faith a bit longer.
Right. These questions at the end, do I confront my dad? Do I give my parents space? Or am I better off without him? It's a moment of crisis. It's a kind of acute moment in your relationship. And there's going to have to be a kind of reckoning from his side as well as yours. And, you know, the bridge for you will be forgiveness and understanding and a lot of patience. And for him, it's going to have to be recalibrating and recognizing that the way that he has related to you is not healthy. It's too bad that the trigger was the planning of the wedding and that it played out at the wedding. But as Lois can tell us, and, you know, we know from our letter writers, that cathartic event is where a lot of the hidden grievance and dysfunction and unhappiness inside of people suddenly explodes into view.
And also, this is, it's so clear that it's so much about loss for the father,
yeah,
who left her mother. So he's lost his wife and his daddy's girl.
Yeah.
So I would look at that and exercise as much sympathy as possible for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lois, you have been such an interesting guest. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Yeah, you are all kinds of awesome.
Oh, thank you so much. And you guys are really way awesome. And congratulations on all your great work.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, I like her so much.
Oh, my God.
I want to go drink champagne
honorary,
at a wedding reception.
Yeah, she's kind of, I like that she's so compassionate. As she was talking, Cheryl, I was thinking about the dad and the speech that the dad has to give. And I was thinking about this novel in particular, which is called Seating Arrangements, Maggie Shipstead's novel of a couple of years back, which is all about the 3 days that a wedding takes place. And it's told mostly from a lot of points of view, mostly from the dad's point of view. And it really is playing out this drama that Daddy's Girl No More is struggling with, which has to do with how a father sort of somehow gracefully finds a way to connect to his daughter, who he is in a certain way losing. It's a complicated and beautiful novel, but right towards the end of it is a beautiful speech, which I think also helps put weddings in perspective as we come to the end of our two-part series. The dad says, "Marriage is difficult." He's saying this. This is his big toast. "Marriage is difficult, perhaps the most difficult thing you can do besides being a parent. But I think these two fine young people are up to it. When you leave the altar tomorrow, there will still be a lifetime of choice and temptation and doubt and uncertainty in front of you. I didn't know that at my wedding. Getting married doesn't change you. Marriage changes you."
Mm-hmm.
What I love about that is that, one, it's a dad who's saying the things that needs to be said and, you know, giving the wisdom that he can give to his daughter. And there's a humility about it. But it also helps put the whole issue of weddings in perspective a little bit.
Absolutely.
It is that big cathartic day. It is that big public, you know, pageant. But it's really just the beginning of the hard work of marriage.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, if you asked me, looking back on my own wedding, it was 1999, if, you know, what I know now about that day that I didn't quite understand then, and that it's really that it was an important day. It was one of the best days of my life. But when it comes right down to it, it was just a big party. And, you know, that I didn't need to get all bound up about every damn thing. And, you know, I was a pretty mellow bride. But, you know, there are things in retrospect that I'm like, okay, you know, why was I worried about the flower arrangements or worried about, you know, where the guests would be standing when they had the glass of champagne or, you know, and all that stuff, I don't even remember it. And
right.
What it is you want to bring people together who matter to you
right.
and have a good time. time.
Right.
And the most sacred and powerful moment of my wedding, and it's the moment that stays with me and I will never forget, is when I was standing there looking Brian in the eyes and he was looking back at me. And we had this moment when we were exchanging our vows that it really hit us both at the same time, that we were getting married to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And tears came into our eyes simultaneously. And aww, that's the moment I treasure most in my wedding.
That's beautiful. And please do not think for a second that I accept the convenient fiction that you are a relatively mellow bride. None of our listeners do either, just so you know. All right. Well, we wish everybody who is at the altar, on the way to the altar, just been at the altar, a beautiful wedding experience. Dear Sugar is produced by WBUR. We are produced and edited by the unmarried but also not quite single Lisa Tobin. We're recording at Talkback Sound and Visual in Portland. Our new theme music is by the Portland musicians known as Wonderly. The vocals are by the wonderful Liz Weiss. Please listen and subscribe on iTunes and write to us if you would at dearsugarradio@gmail.com and send your wedding photos.